So again, I thank you all for being here. I just want to give a quick background about this discussion. We were going to have, there were two proposals. One was on sort of domestic legal developments related to Native American issues, and one was international, especially in the context of protected areas or avoided deforestation, and that's coming up a lot, Native American or indigenous people's rights, and in the advent of a major effort to avoid deforestation. So we merged the two together, and I think you'll see today we have issues that overlap international and domestic, especially with regard to climate change, human rights, even if there's resistance to human rights courts in the United States, still the norms enter the discourse, and the same thing with genetic resources, which Professor Vicki Sutton will bring in. And so I want to thank Talia Naumann, Jay Leto, Adam Hintertower, and of course Randy Loftus for their help with this session, and of course our panelists, who I'll introduce in a second, Elizabeth Cronk, Aaron Daugherty, and Vicki Sutton. Elizabeth and Aaron come from far, Elizabeth from Kansas, Aaron all the way from Alaska, so many thanks. And I'll go a little more formally into their bios, three sentences for background. But since we've got a nice, small, intimate group, let's introduce ourselves, and then we can get going with our presenters talking for 10 minutes and then open discussion, 10 minutes each. So please welcome and thanks for coming.
Tristan Dyer.
Elizabeth Cronk is an associate professor and director of the Tribal Law and Government Center at the University of Kansas School of Law. She is an enrolled member of the St. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians and serves as an appellate judge for her tribe's Court of Appeals. In 2010, Elizabeth was selected to serve as an Environmental Justice Young Fellow through the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and U.S.-China Partnership for Environmental Law at Vermont Law School. Oh, please welcome. Professor Cronk's scholarship focuses on the intersection of federal, Indian, and tribal law with environmental and natural resources law. So exactly what we're here for. She has previously chaired the Native American Bar Association of D.C. and the Federal Bar Association Indian Law Section. And I think she has a handout for a forthcoming book here in this room, Climate and Indigenous People's Search for Legal Remedies. Okay. So please contact her for that if we don't see it around her. And again, thanks for coming from Kansas. And Aaron Daugherty coming all the way from Alaska. And thanks very much for being here. She's a staff attorney at the Native American Rights Fund in Anchorage, Alaska. At NARF, the Native American Rights Fund, Aaron works on a variety of Indian law and tribal jurisdiction issues, including a project to assist Alaska Natives in their efforts to relocate coastal villages threatened by erosion and other problems associated with climate change. She is a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School, and prior to law school, she was a Fulbright Scholar based in University of Tromsø, Norway. And also keep another piece of literature to keep in mind coming out soon. She has an academic piece on tribal court jurisdiction in Alaska. So please talk to her about that. And then again, our first presenter, Vicki Sutton, who's doing quite a few things for us here at SCJ, including a panel discussion tomorrow, right?
Panel and a workshop today. A roundtable today.
I'll join too on just environmental law in general, or maybe
it's
clean water.
Social movement and environmental law.
Social movement. Okay, thank you. So she's doing quite a bit for us. Vicki is a professor of law, School of Law, here at Texas Tech. Director of the Center for Biodefense, Law and Public Policy. She's Director of Law and Science Certificate Program in the JDMS program, the Life Sciences Institute of Environmental and Human Health, Texas Tech. She is an enrolled member of the Lumbee Indian Nation and served as Secretary of the National Native American Bar Association 2001 to 2002, and she currently serves as an advisor council member of the National Congress of American Indian Policy Research Center. And am I correct, you include advising on biotech issues?
Yeah.
In this capacity. Had positions including public information officer for Chesapeake, Virginia, worked at EPA and White House, too. So thanks very much for being here. And we're going to begin with Vicki's presentation for 10 minutes each, and we'll have plenty of time to open up at the end of the presentations.
Thank you. First, I want to welcome everyone to Lubbock. I can't tell you how happy I am to see you here coming to Lubbock. And I think that probably all of you are involved in the environment because you love the environment. That's probably what inspired you to get into it in the first place. It was for me. And so I know that you notice the special beauty that we have in Lubbock. At first thought, you might think it's just a flat, ordinary sort of surface, but the beauty here with this environment is remarkable. And if you notice the sunset from the first day, it's pretty spectacular. And we do have an amazing array of wildlife here also. And something that's unique, we're still kind of a frontier in many ways. So we have farming and we have energy at a huge rate in this part of the United States. So you get a chance to see how all of that is balanced with environmental preservation and especially water conservation here. So I hope you enjoy your time here. We are delighted to have you here. And I hope you have experienced some of the friendly hospitality that we are typically known for. If you haven't, come see me immediately and I'll straighten it out. Welcome, and we're really happy to have you here. Hope you enjoy it. So I will go ahead now and get started with my presentation. And my presentation is on the end of the spectrum in some ways with genetic resources. And genetic resources are tied very closely to the land, control over the land, regulation of the land. And so for that reason, I used the springboard of the Convention on Biological Diversity, which I think hasn't been used a whole lot for indigenous rights, but I think it should be. So I wanted to use an example of, I think, a successful application of Article 8J and 15 of the Convention on Biological Diversity and the management of indigenous genetic resources. And example is in the South Pacific and indigenous societies because you do have often a majority of the population, you have an opportunity to control the dominant legal system to some degree. And when you do that, then you're able to incorporate indigenous traditions of environmental management into the dominant legal system. And that's what they've done in some places very successfully in the South Pacific. So I just want to give you a quick look at a coral reef, because I'm going to use a coral reef as an example. A coral reef is unique because it's a combination of two animals, as you know. You have an algae, and then you also have this photosynthesis going on that gives it its color. And so you have to make sure that the sunlight isn't blocked with silt and so forth. And so you have to keep it fairly clean. You have to make sure the animals that keep it clean are healthy. And that's what the job is of maintaining the coral reef. And that's traditionally been done by the indigenous societies in recognition of that. So here's a couple of the kinds of things the starfish eat coral reefs. That's a natural phenomena, but you have to know about it and be able to respond to it and deal with it. So the life around a coral reef arguably has more biodiversity than a rainforest. And you can find articles that say that, in fact, it does. So it's a very important part of our world ecology, which means we really should be paying attention to traditional management systems because they've learned something after 1,000 or so years on how to manage them. And we haven't done it all that successfully ourselves with our existing legal structures and marine zones and so forth. So what they found in studies is that social factors actually have the greatest impact on protecting coral reefs, even more than biological or physical factors, which would extend to regulation and tradition. So the social factors really have more to do with it than anything, which is another reason we should be paying attention to this system. And just to put it all into perspective, these are the areas of the world where we have the most active areas of coral reefs that we should really be paying attention to. The diseased coral, as you see, is around the United States, between the Americas, overfishing, destruction, and so forth. But we do have areas of the world where they're still large and healthy and still being maintained by indigenous people. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot, but not all, of our indigenous management system in the Caribbean. I just didn't want to believe that we didn't have any remnants of it left. But in Dominica, we still have a society that practices traditional management systems, although it's not widespread. We do have one island in the Caribbean that does. So, there we go. And of course, you know the story of Easter Island, the failure to manage the ecology. And island ecology is very fragile. It has lower biodiversity. It might surprise you, but it has lower biodiversity just because it has less places to have it, and you have a closed ecosystem for the most part. So the legal basis of my springboard for this is Article 8J and Article 15. Article 8J specifically says that you need to be aware of traditional environmental management systems and allow those to operate. And it's so important that the CBD administration has a directorate called the Article 8J Directorate. So it actually has a whole unit that focuses on administering Article 8J. Article 15 also has a directorate, and it's focused on specifically genetic resources. And out of that has spun the BON guidelines, which give very specific guidelines for how to deal with indigenous populations if you're there exploring for biological discoveries in plants for pharmaceutical companies, for example. The term biopiracy has kind of spun out of the failure to follow those guidelines and going in and sticking in backpacks samples of plants and leaving without, one, conferring with the tribal government, and two, paying and making an agreement on either and or royalties and a front payment. And that's the general requirement for dealing with exploring for indigenous resources. Article 8 of the ILO Convention also addresses recognizing tribal regulations and laws. And then, of course, Human Rights International.
International Labor Organization?
Yes. Yes. And the Human Rights International Law, both principles and customary law, also are at play here in regulating this. So HA says, respect, preserve, and maintain knowledge and innovations and practices that embody traditional lifestyles that are relevant to conservation and sustainable use of biological diversity. That is such an important statement. And I think the reason we don't see it coming up in indigenous law so much is because it's in the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, and it's not a place we typically go to find rights. But it is a very important right, and it's one that is right on target for maintaining control of the land. So this doesn't, I think one of the reasons it probably doesn't come up is because notice it doesn't say ownership of the land, but it certainly is control of the land, which is second best to owning the land. So, and it's a step toward, control is certainly a step toward, and possession toward ultimately occupying land. So I think this is really an important provision that I think could be used. Here's Article 8 in the ILO. Again, recognizing customs and customary law of traditional societies is important. Now, I wanted to give you an example in Fiji in the observance of tribal land. Actually, I believe this is Tahiti. This one is Tahiti. There are actually terms that embody these practices, the Aboriginal ownership and control of land, and looking after it in an Aboriginal way, Manta. And the national park, however, may be national conservation in the Western way. So how do you put those two together? How do you allow those two to operate? And that's the goal, is to allow observer Aboriginal law in the context of Western management of national parks. And the three indigenous groups have different traditions, but I just want to be aware this is kind of the way it's divided up in the South Pacific, and these are the islands that fall into the indigenous groups, and then Polynesia. Fiji, as you see, is Melanesia, and Polynesia are my two examples here. So in theories of enforcement, there is the right holder's interest in real property, there's an economic theory of law, and then there's a theory of quote, third world environmentalism. So how does this work? Well, in terms of looking for enforcing biological resources, how do you ever go back to a village and identify who it is that you need to talk to about natural resources. Well, Fiji has come up with a really good way to index it, and this is an example of tradition being incorporated into a dominant legal system. And these are this is the way that you would find the identification of the Slato plant. The Slato plant is a plant that causes itching when it's rubbed on your skin. So it has some interesting properties that a pharmaceutical company might be interested in. So if they came to Fiji and they wanted to get some samples of the Slato plant, they would go, this is what they would do. They would go to the index that is in the government building, and they keep their laws, of course, on the shelf in hard copy in the government building, but they actually index first the province, then the island, then the village, then the tribe, then the plant. You might say this is their federalism system. And by identifying the plant by this indexing, you know exactly who has control, possession, ownership, management, responsibility. And how did they come up with this? Well, this goes back to tradition. Families have been responsible for the Slato plant, and that tribe and the plant is who is responsible for it. I'll give you an interesting example of that. You may have heard of this. The Raui is the tradition of avoiding using, for example, an estuary that used to be the responsibility of an elder. And when they die, a one-year moratorium is established for that estuary. And it has some functions. It gives some recharging time for the estuary in a practical sense. But how is it enforced? Well, the enforcement is interesting because stories of people who drown or die after they go in there has a really good enforcement effect. The problem is it doesn't help if you don't know that. And a lot of tourists will unknowingly wander in there and then violate the tribal enforcement. And then stories of the tourists dying also perpetuate the problem. But that is one way of enforcement, is knowing that it's socially prohibited, and there's also a possibility of bad things happening to you if you do it. The Blue Ideal is another interesting aspect of Tahiti. A family goes and maintains the eels and feeds them, and there are stories of feeding them canned food. And in modern society, they bring canned food and salmon, and they jump out of the water and eat it. But these Blue Ideals are critical to keeping the mangroves clean, that and the water that rolls from there into the coral reef has to be clean, or it will kill the corals. And so the Blue Ideals are really integral to keeping that coral reef clean. And so for centuries, the tribe has known this and make sure the eels are healthy and alive, because they know that will maintain their food source in the coral reef. 2 minutes, okay. I'm at the end. The South Pacific Indigenous Management System, working in this way with the dominant legal system, is one way to accept that. The challenges for this is you can't put the system in without flexibility, because traditional systems have to change. That's why they work. So you can't really codify them in a way they can change. The indexing system is a good way to allow it to change. And failure to incorporate it ends up with two worlds. So I would like to give the example of Tahiti and French occupation. The French have never been really good, I don't think, in incorporating traditional government systems into law. So they operate as if they don't know each other is there. The French have a map, and indigenous people have a map, and they don't know the other one exists. It's like two overlays. Adopting traditions and opinions. Custom is adopted in formal opinions also there. Difficulties, of course, are outsiders that don't know it. And then the seventh generation theory of law then is what I think is the best description of this, is that it's a way of preserving for the seventh generation through this kind of traditional carrying on through the families of taking care of plants. And you'll hear more about the seventh generation theory of law from my colleagues who will follow here, the panel.
Thanks, Vicki. Before we move on to Elizabeth, I just want to say there are lots of really good stories on genetic resources, and please do contact Vicki Sutton. One of the problems is that the United States is about maybe the only one of four nations not ratifying the Convention on Biological Diversity. Mm-hmm. But the norms do shape our business, our commerce, our interaction in a very big way. And you get a big delegation, like 35 people, to the CBD meetings. So, but lots of stories there. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I wanted to just mention, I left some articles on wind. I did have a couple of articles on wind and indigenous people in case anyone has an interest in that area as well.
Thank you. Thanks, Elizabeth.
All right. Well, good morning. It is a pleasure and privilege to be here because I don't usually get to talk to journalists. I have a tendency to talk just to lawyers, so it's nice to get out and talk to a different group, and hopefully this will give us an opportunity to kind of brainstorm through our discussion session and talk about different issues that we might not otherwise talk about. So I'm passing around two things. I'm passing around a flyer of that book that Richard mentioned to you. Helpful resource, just because obviously in 10 minutes I can't talk about climate change and its impacts around the world and legal solutions around the world. It's a rather massive topic that requires 800 pages in a book. So if you're interested in the book, I refer you to this. Dr. Sutton has contributed a chapter specific on Fiji as well, so if you're interested in her work in terms of Fiji and the South Pacific, you can see her discussion of climate change impacts in that book as well. Also, a nice thing about this flyer is for those of you who are writing in the area of climate change, which I imagine many of you are, given it's probably our largest environmental threat to date, it'll give you some resources in the legal field. You'll see it's broken down by chapter, by topic, so feel free to contact those individuals if you want to talk to somebody who's an expert in that specific field and in those particular indigenous cultures. So I refer you to that. So I'm going to talk to you today. I've titled my presentation on Working Towards the Seventh Generation, Legal Solutions to Climate Change Available to Indigenous People. Now, I use that term very loosely, solutions. Obviously, going to the courts or going through a contract is not necessarily a solution, but it can provide certain remedies for our indigenous nations, which are being disproportionately impacted by climate change. So it's not a solution in the sense that we're not going to stop climate change by going to the courts, but hopefully we can provide some remedies to these communities who are being disproportionately impacted. Seventh generation is a term you hear a lot in Indian country. Different nations use that term differently. So for example, in some Lakota Dakota traditions, we're currently in the sixth generation, meaning that we are the teachers. We're preparing the world for the seventh generation who is going to help us survive and going to repair the earth. I think really poignant in terms of climate change. Some nations think of seventh generation in terms of you are the center. Two generations before you, typically you know your parents and your grandparents. You typically will know two generations after you. You will know your children and your grandchildren. And then we think one generation before and one generation coming after your grandchildren, the seven generations. Regardless of which nation you're talking about, I think the big takeaway and why it's particularly applicable in the climate change framework is because it's talking about long term. And obviously our solutions, or anytime we're talking about climate change, we're looking at that in the long term. So, brief presentation overview, how are indigenous communities being uniquely impacted by climate change? And then I'm going to go over a couple of different examples of legal solutions, again, using that term very loosely, solutions that various nations have used to start to address the impacts of climate change. I know that Aaron's going to go a lot more in depth into a discussion of what are the impacts of climate change in the Arctic. So the Arctic and the South Pacific are two of the regions where our indigenous populations are seeing dramatic impacts of climate change. In the Arctic, we literally have communities such as Kivalina, which I'll talk to you about in one moment, where they're falling into the sea because of the erosion of the sea land and the sea ice on which the communities subsist. In the South Pacific, we're seeing, similarly enough, a loss of land because of inundation, because of seawater levels rising, and then also other subsistence impacts such as coral reef loss that Dr. Sutton was talking to you about. So those are two dramatic areas where literally within our lifetime we could see communities be dispossessed of their land, which leads to really interesting challenges of climate mitigation, climate refugees. Dr. Sutton talks about this in her chapter in the climate change book. So these are things that we are going to be facing in the future. But because of that second point up there of why we're different, we as indigenous communities, I am a member of a tribe, so I use that term in the inclusive. We are different because we have a unique connection to land that other communities don't necessarily have. And one thing that is truly unique in the United States is our legal connection to land. Because many of our indigenous nations in the United States have been put onto a specific piece of land through various historical reasons, whether that's a reservation, an allotment, or the third category under the legal definitions of dependent Indian community. We have been put on this piece of land, and so that narrows our ability to adapt. Other communities can move, right? If you're not happy with what's happening in your community, you get up and you move. If you're not happy with saltwater infiltration in southern Florida, you move to northern Florida, you move back to New York. That's more difficult for us in Indian country, where we are specifically conscribed to specific pieces of land through treaties, through the history, and so it limits our ability to adapt and to move. Another way where this is really important is a lot of our indigenous communities, and I think Aaron's going to talk about this more in depth because it's particularly hitting our Arctic nations, and not just our indigenous here in the United States, also the Sami people, you might be familiar with them, from Russia and from Northern Europe, are overly reliant on caribou and reindeer herds. And as climate change is impacting these environments, we're seeing these herds where the nations have relied upon them for subsistence reasons and for economy reasons, the herds are moving. Well, the nations can't move with them because of these legal connections to land. And so that's one important way that we're different from other communities. Other communities are certainly being impacted by climate change, but because of our legal connection to the land, we're different. We're also different because many of our communities have important and substantial cultural, spiritual, and historical connections to land. Again, this isn't to say that other communities don't have that connection. It's just that that's more pervasive within our communities that you might see in the dominant non-Native culture. And so those raise really important questions of trauma to our communities. So, for example, using the Kivalina example, the Arctic again, Kivalina is losing their land. The native village of Kivalina will cease to exist probably in 10 to 15, 20 years.
Maybe less.
Yeah. Maybe less. Yeah. Definitely within our lifetime. What does that do to those people as a peoplehood when they lose body of land that their ancestors have been perpetually connected to since time immemorial? What does that do to a people? What does that do to their sovereignty? Sovereignty is usually connected to territoriality. So these are important questions that do uniquely touch Native communities and are pervasive throughout the United States. Also, ways that we are different is sovereignty. I always like to get some interesting faces from my first-year law students when I go in and I tell them, does the Constitution of the United States apply in Indian country? And they say, oh, yes, yes, it applies, it applies. And I say, no. And they go, what? The Constitution of the United States doesn't apply. And that's because we pre-existed the formation of the federal government. So we've had inherent sovereignty that pre-exists the existence of the federal government, pre-exists the formation of states. And that's important. And so anytime you're talking about Indian country, impacts to Indian country, you have to start with the assumption that tribes have the sovereignty and have the ability to act. Now, if this were federal Indian law 101, we'd talk about how Congress has divested tribes of some aspects of their sovereignty, but we still start from the presumption that tribes have inherent sovereignty. That's where we always start. Another important way that tribes are different is because of the federal trust responsibility. So I just told you that over the ensuing centuries, tribes have been divested of the federal government of aspects of their sovereignty. That started in 1823, 1830, 1831 with three Supreme Court cases called the Marshall Trilogy of Cases, referring to then Chief Justice Marshall, who wrote all three opinions. And what happened there is Chief Justice Marshall basically surmised, again, what we could spend weeks talking about. He said that tribes had lost their external sovereignty to the United States by virtue of being conquered by the United States. However, in return for losing external sovereignty, the federal government owes a duty of protection to those tribes. He used rather racist language to say that. But basically the idea is that by giving up external sovereignty, the federal government owes a duty of obligation to tribes in return. Fast forward to last year, 2011, and you may have heard of a case called Hickory Apache Nation versus the United States. I won't go into details of the case. If you're interested afterwards, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. But basically, Hickory Apache Nation is a modern 2011 Supreme Court decision telling us what does the trust responsibility mean today. And the Supreme Court says that to have an enforceable trust responsibility, meaning to have a compensable claim against the United States, so something more than a moral claim. And you can certainly make a moral claim, it's just that the courts won't give you money for it. So to have a monetary claim in the courts, you have to be able to show that there's some sort of statute or treaty or some explicit statement from Congress saying that the federal government will take on a management or control function in Indian country. If you can show that, and some tribes have, again, I'd be happy to talk to you about the details of that, then the federal government is responsible financially for compensating tribes for those takings. That's an important when you think of climate change, because if tribes are in a situation where they can argue that the federal government had a duty to manage that land or to provide them protection under the federal trust responsibility, then potentially you can go to court and you have a compensable taking in court. So those are some important reasons why we're different. I'm going to talk a little bit about
these agencies have rules that if they know that a community is leaving or is going to move an infrastructure, that agency can't then invest money in fixing the infrastructure in the village that is failing. And so you've got a situation where the people have not been able to move yet, but at the same time, the infrastructure that is there is not being maintained. So getting everyone in the same room to talk about what's going on in the current village site is really important. And then getting people in the same room to sort of strategize about how to leverage funds from different agencies and different grant opportunities. And you know, I go to these meetings every quarter, and they're actually great. Like, you sit, someone from BIA will be sitting in the room talking to someone from DOT. 2 minutes. Okay, cruise along. And, you know, the different agencies have different cost share requirements, and they sit there and strategize and think about how to leverage all of these resources to move the community along. Earlier this year, NewTok finalized a strategic management plan, which stages all the different phases of the relocation. They have a barge landing at Mektarvik now. They have the foundation for an evacuation center that will serve the community when the next big flood happens. After the community moves, that evacuation center will be turned into a community center. And they have 6 homes that are built there now, and they're in the process of, they have selected and then are in the process of moving families over to Pioneer. So, just very quickly, the last example that I want to mention is an example of tribes working directly with industry. And I'm really sorry that map is so poor, but, basically, the upper bits of that map show sort of the Nome region, and the lower parts show the Bethel region. But the Bering Sea Elders Group is a group of 29 villages, so it's not just one tribe. It's a group of, 39 tribes that have all signed resolutions that have each nominated one elder to serve on this council. And they are working on the issue of halibut protection and walrus protection areas off the coast of Western Alaska, and they are working specifically with the bottom trawl industry. So for those of you who know about fishing in federal waters, you know that those decisions are made largely by fishery management councils. And Alaska Natives have no representation on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Those of you who know about working with councils also know that process can take years and years. It's not as long as litigation, but it can still take quite a long time. And so one of the things that the elders group has done is to work directly with the co-op that represents all of the bottom trawlers in this area. And they've been negotiating with them for 2 years to sort of move the current bottom trawl boundary further offshore for greater protection of halibut and walrus areas. Halibut are a really important subsistence species. Bottom trawling goes after, they're targeting yellowfin sole, but in the process they pick up an incredible amount of halibut, which are thrown overboard. They're not allowed by law to keep that halibut, so that halibut is almost pure waste. So we've seen huge reductions in the number of halibut available in the last few years. In addition to a reduction in the number of halibut, we've seen that the halibut are just smaller. They're not as big as they used to be. No one knows why this is. But it's very important, obviously, for the bottom trawl fleet to lower their bycatch, but in that area, and it's important for the elders to maintain that subsistence resource as well. And so the two have gotten together, and I can't give you much more information than this, unfortunately, because it was just agreed to last month, and we're still sort of hammering out the details. But there are some boundary adjustments to provide for walrus migration routes and a walrus haul-out area. But the most important takeaway of this negotiation is the establishment of a working group moving forward. And that means that the elders and the communities in this area are going to have the ability to actually be active participants in the management of this area, which
Elizabeth was talking about earlier, the idea of incorporating traditional knowledge it's almost like the two different maps, like the two different overlays of the traditional knowledge of the area and then of the science that's been done by the council. And it's been a very interesting process, because they come at it from completely different angles. The elders come at this process thinking about things holistically as an ecosystem, whereas different fisheries come at it thinking of it as only their fishery and how they're impacting their fishery. So it's exciting because they're going to have the ability to be involved in the conversation moving forward. And it's also a much more adaptive process because if a problem is noted with a certain area, the trawl fleet can move out of that area the very next day. Whereas if you were trying to renegotiate a boundary like that for a problem area through the council, it would take years. Just the final slide. If you're interested in learning more about issues that are popping up because of climate change in Alaska, I've put a couple different resources up there. Michael Brubaker runs this this great service, basically, where he takes every article that's been written about a climate issue in Alaska that week and sends out a mailing at the end of the week. And his stuff, I find, is very helpful because he also covers stories from KYUK, which is the local radio station in the Bethel area, and he covers local Alaska indigenous news. So if you're looking to sort of learn more about that, it's a good resource. The Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy does great webinars which highlight little known issues. And then that's my contact information. And I also have my card here. So that's it.
Terrific. Yeah, Erin, you gave us so much to think and to write about or present about in journalism, so thank you very much. We have about 10 minutes for discussion. I have a few questions, but let's go around. Anybody have a question? And please introduce yourself one more time, too.
Oh, sure. My name is Emily Gertz. I'm a freelancer based in New York City. I'm going to have to walk out right after I get my answer. I'm sorry. Some years ago, I did a bit of reporting on the efforts of some members of the Inuit Circumpolar Council to use the Inter-American, Commission on Human Rights as a means to get the U.S. to take stronger action to curb carbon emissions. And I wondered what was going on with that effort. Just that effort to use the international human rights regime.
Yeah, so I'm writing an article on this right now. From a legal perspective, the effort failed, and that was because, as you may be familiar, the United States has a dismal record on recognizing international forest judgment against the United States. So even though the Inter-American Commission has repeatedly found, not only in that context, but also in other contexts, some of you might have called the Dan sisters, for example, in Western Shoshone, the United States has not appeared as a party and not participated in enforcement. But interestingly enough, there's an interesting discussion of a legal solution versus a public relations effort. So Hari Ososki, who is a professor at the University of Minnesota, followed this, and afterwards, because the goal of Inuit was arguably to get the message out and to start all these discussions so everything that Erin talked about could then happen, or at least the ball could get rolling and people would be aware of the problem. Hari did this interesting empirical research to see how many people were actually talking about, how many articles were published after that petition was submitted and it was adjudicated. And what happened is it went from zero to over 100 hits in 1 month. Partly because of you, probably in your reporting. So from a legal perspective, the petition was unsuccessful, but from a PR perspective, the Inuit have claimed victory in that people know about the issue and we're actively reporting. So it's an interesting dynamic between the legal sphere and the sphere of public opinion.
It just seems with the incredibly rapid advance of oil companies into the Arctic, that kind of thing needs to take on a new level of urgency. I guess that's an advocacy statement that I'm not supposed to make, but certainly I'd like more opportunities to cover that kind of story. So, it would be great to be hearing from folks in the NAS that make those efforts.
There are legal organizations that are working on this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so for example, in Inuit, it was the Center for International Environmental Law that partnered with Inuit.
Oh, sure, right. Right.
Yeah, and one thing I'm interested in is I was telling you about the trust relationship. So you have to, under the trust relationship, in order to have a legally enforceable claim, you have to have this binding framework. And one question I'm kind of interested in exploring, haven't done so yet, so I don't have the answer to it, is whether or not the international framework that Dr. Sutton was talking about could be used where the United States has signed on. So, for example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the signature as a, it's just a declaration, but to buttress that argument, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, could that ever be used to create a framework to create, which would then create the federal, a binding federal trust relationship? That's an argument that I admittedly will say is out there, but it's a discussion I think is worth having.
And my question is, the United States under the Obama administration has quietly endorsed the United Nations Declarations on Rights of Indigenous People.
Explicitly, just in December of 2010.
Right. Oh. But they could have made it bigger.
Yes, I guess we were quietly, yes. It was.
Yeah. Okay.
But yes, we have adopted it.
Okay, thank you.
And the earlier administration rejected it. Okay. Any other questions? I think we can. Yeah, I have a couple of questions, if not. Just one question from me. With the first of all, Kivalina, I'm on Bar Association, listservs, and I get notice of Kivalina, but the picture is worth a thousand words, my goodness. And as a TV journalist, conveying it through tape, if you're in radio too, about that. Is this like a pushback? Environmental law often starts with nuisance, and isn't this sort of a rejection of a nuisance argument that what you're doing is a nuisance to my property? And I'm wondering if, how you might look upon that as something fundamental that environmentalism in America starts with, and the pushback of it. Am I correct?
Well, again, Erin's in a difficult position because this is an active case, and her organization is representing. So she's in a difficult position, so she can't comment on it. So I'm sure she has really interesting thoughts on that, but she can't.
She's very articulate.
I would just say that from my perspective, and Dr. Sutton is an expert in environmental law as well, so I'm sure she has thoughts as well. You're right in that what we're seeing in the litigation related to climate change in indigenous country is very much analogous to the development of environmental law overall, right? So before the late 1960s and early 1970s and Richard Carson's work, we largely relied on common law tools in order to move forward environmental law. So communities largely relied on trespass actions, nuisance actions, etc. So we did have environmental law, it just wasn't until the 1960s and 1970s that the federal government really started to take an active role. I mean, the federal government was involved before, but really became active in the late 1960s and 1970s. So in that way, it's analogous because you see communities coming forward with these common law claims like Kivalina. And then with Connecticut versus AP and the Obama administration trying to regulate under the Clean Air Act, you start to see the federal government taking a more active role. So that reduces the ability to use the common law claims. So I would agree that there's a lot of mirrors between what was the traditional projection of environmental law and what has been kind of the trajectory of climate change litigation.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I think that the idea of using nuisance, there's still lots of room for it. It hasn't been completely foreclosed by the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, although that was a double-edged sword, incorporating climate change concerns, CO2 regulation into the Clean Air Act, because then it foreclosed those common law remedies. But there's still plenty of room for that, although most of them are going to be very specific personal actions. It's going to be private nuisance, not public nuisance, for the most part, that succeed. But there's still room for it. It's still out there, and it's still pushing the field.
And still state actions, too.
Yeah.
Good questions. You spoke a lot about existing laws, and I hate laws, way too slow. But do you see any hope in future arguments like ecocide or rights of Mother Earth and things like that that are happening in other parts of the world?
Yeah, yes, in the sense that I always encourage using those types of arguments to buttress the legal arguments. So I think those policy arguments, especially as we've seen a lot of communities communities around the world move in the direction that you're talking about, I think that that's certainly persuasive. The problem in the United States court system, from my perspective, is that, especially with the current Supreme Court justices and kind of a trickle-down effect, is there's a lot of reticence to look towards the development of international law. So while I think that those types of developments can be used to support your domestic claims, I don't see it anytime soon changing as far as being an independent basis, legal basis. But I think that that's all good things to support a domestic claim. The trick right now is to try and find the domestic hook. And that's more challenging. And that's what I sit in my office thinking about. How can I create that domestic hook?
Okay, if anybody has one more question before we do our breakout networking, move on, I guess, downstairs. Any other last question or comment you wish to share with us?
Can I just add one bit about DNA and the genetic resources? I covered the environmental aspect, but there's also a human DNA experimentation, whole world of that that's out there that also happens in the South Pacific, but it also happens in the United States. We recently had litigation in Arizona because of the misuse of human DNA. And I just want to add that the NCAI created a DNA guide for researchers, and it's the first one of its kind. It was badly needed, and any responsible researcher should use it to make sure that they're being sensitive to community concerns with any kind of DNA research that they do. And, of course, tribes are particularly attractive for genetic resources because they tend to be isolated pools of genes which are easier to identify markers in. So they love to try to find those genetic pools. So it's really important that more people know about this guide. So if all of you know about it, that's a great step forward. And it just came out this year. So.
And that is a fascinating case and has a lot of implications for universities.
What's the name of the case?
Remember the Havasupai?
That's the tribe.
Yeah, the tribe.
Is that in one state?
Arizona State. Grand Canyon, and basically a researcher befriended them, convinced them to give the researcher blood samples to be used for diabetes research, and then turned around and used those blood samples on a whole host of research that was very offensive to the tribe.
Everything.
And didn't tell them. And sold them, gave blood samples to other researchers. They did inbreeding studies, which was
horrible.
Yeah. So, it's had a lot of implications for institutional review boards and people at universities doing research on native populations. So.
It was just too much to cover in one.
But thank you. You've given us great amount of information and new story ideas and also great background. And really thank our speakers. Thank you very much. Thank you all.